Our journey back into horny moments in 1970s history continues as Bo Derek is here to give Dudley Moore a midlife crisis simply by existing. Much to the alphabetical confusion of generations of video store clerks, it is simply called 10, and it was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
It's the number one movie in America. My name's Sean Collier. I'm here with a vacationing couple caught up in a shipwreck. It's Robin Hitchcock.
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat?
The one does kind of precede the other. And Camila Adams.
Ahoy.
That's what Little Mermaid is about. Ursula wanted the morphine.
Now it all makes sense. That makes a much better movie.
So this is both the part of the show where we reflect a little bit on last week's movie and a segue into this week's movie. Were people more easily amused in the late 70s?
I think so. Because
was it just easier to get people?
It's like, you know, hey, we've got these people pretending to be other people that are on this film thing.
It's a moving picture.
Right. Gather together now, boys and girls. Come on and see the talkies.
Well, and we kind of had the same conversation when we did Oh God, You Devil. And I had gone back and watched Oh God. And, like, this isn't universal. We just watched Alien. Right. Like, I wouldn't say this about Fiddler of the Roof. Fiddler of the Roofs. Fiddler on the Roof. Like, there's plenty of movies from this era that are beginning to end engaging and interesting. Mm-hmm. But it seemed that there was a lot more patience for nothing's really happening, but okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. And I didn't really pay attention or look at it. But was Nick Nolte already kind of a star at that point in his career?
In the Deep?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think that was his first major movie.
Okay. And what about, like, Dudley Moore? Like, he was already, like, Arthur.
Dudley Moore was a known quantity, but this is pre-Arthur.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, yeah, Arthur's 81.
I got nothing then. I don't know.
The fact that we have two movies in consecutive weeks that are from the same era, that both were in the top 10 earners in their respective years, and we'll get into our thoughts on them much more, obviously, but, like, generally are very, like, I don't know, I guess
sure.
Stuff happened, like
like, nah,
okay,
what, that was a movie. There were people that wrote some words and people who said those words, and somebody captured it.
And to address it, even pre-recap, they just picked a deliberately difficult title for this. Like, I thought it would be a thing that constantly he's going, you don't understand, she's a 10.
Right.
No.
But no, he says it once, and he says, no, she's an 11.
Right, exactly.
It would make so much more sense to me if this movie were called 11.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought that was going to be it right there. Okay, here's the big thing. She's a 10. No, she's an 11. I'm like, okay, so nothing. We got nothing on this. And I did put together a nice list of things that I think the number 10 actually refers to where this movie is concerned.
Oh, so. Let's lead off
yes,
with that.
Yes, Madam.
Pre-recap.
All right, so things the title 10 refers to. George's level of stalking. George's mental age. The number Sam has to count to so she doesn't smother George in his sleep. The number of STDs George picked up during this midlife crisis. The number of minutes I could stand talking to Jenny. And the number of times I left the room while this movie was playing. So
so it's a good title is what you're saying.
Yes. That's... You gotta dig deep. You gotta dig real deep.
Yeah, I mean, I assume there are people out here who love this movie, but...
I don't understand how it was so iconic. Like, what?
Okay, so here's my theory, and I don't know if this is true. I think that maybe a lot of tropes that exist in rom-coms were set by this film.
Interesting.
So, like, you know, I didn't see Pulp Fiction until like the year 2000, which is only 6 years after it came out. But I remember when I saw it being like, oh, I've seen people imitate this over and over and over again for the last 6 years.
Right.
So watching the thing that broke that ground, even though it's derivative of everything from the 70s, yada, yada, yada. I was like, I'm missing the moment here. Right. Like I'm not appreciating Pulp Fiction the way that people appreciated it when it came out, because I've seen so many things do the same thing kind of worse.
Right.
This maybe in many ways was like a prototypical modern romantic comedy.
Without the comedy?
Right. I mean, I laughed out loud a few times.
There were a couple things, mostly like, you know, some snide remarks that Julie Andrews had to throw
Julie
in there.
Julie Andrews was genuinely funny. Yeah. Like, there's some slapsticky stuff that happened that I really cracked up when he crashed the car in the beginning. That got me. But I mean, I just think that it feels so like trite at this point, and it wasn't at the time. That's my best guess. Plus, people were super horny for boobs under wet fabric.
Yes, that was like a genre in itself.
Yeah, for the second week in a row. I mean, here's a double feature. You'd be very bored, but if you've got like 4.5 hours to kill and no access to porn, you could watch The Deep in 10 and probably get where you're going. With that setup, it could be a very brief one. Here's Camila with a 60-second recap of 10.
Famous songwriter George Weber just turned 42 and is going through a midlife crisis. While driving, he sees this beautiful young woman on her wedding day and follows her limo to the church. He even sneaks in for a bit. Later that night, George picks a shitty fight with his girlfriend, Sam. This sets off a week of Three's Company misunderstandings. George tricks the priest who officiated the wedding into giving him info on the bride. She's Jenny Miller and her father is a dentist. Obviously, George makes a dental appointment with her father and finds out she's honeymooning in Mexico. After getting 6 cavities filled, popping pain pills, and boozing it up, George finds his way to his neighbor's orgy. Sam finds him there too. George does the adult thing and books a trip to Mexico. He gets shit-faced, picks up Dee Wallace at the bar and ruins her self-esteem real quick. He gawks at Jenny on the beach a bit, then goes for a boat ride. He ends up saving Jenny's husband, who fell asleep on a surfboard. George finally goes to talk to Jenny, takes her to dinner, walks on the beach. She fucks him while her new husband is in the hospital. We are all underwhelmed. She just wants to fuck, and George's feelings are hurt, and he tries to make her feel bad about her life choices. He goes back home and makes nice with Sam. This movie has the confidence of a mediocre white man.
Very well done.
Commentary and recap all in 55 seconds. Excellent.
Yeah. It was like,
I am honestly relieved that Jenny got to talk, because I really thought she might not.
Me too. Like, I marked it 1:15 and I was questioning, does Bo Derek have any lines in this movie?
I like really had convinced myself that she was going to not speak the entire movie, and that was going to break me.
Because she is like everything. Like, I don't know. This is the reason why anybody knows who she is.
Correct.
And I don't know, like, is this just the first time anybody has seen a white woman with cornrows on film?
I think, like, is maybe? I don't know. I genuinely was like, is she the person who has led my generation of women astray into so much cultural appropriation, of which, truthfully, I was only spared because I've never been to the Caribbean.
Right.
Yeah.
And it gets like worse progressively through her stay in Mexico. Like, before it's just cornrows, and then the next shot she's got cornrows and beads, and then the next shot she's got feathers, and then there's more feathers. She's got a full out fucking nest in her head.
Also, the sound guys clearly could not handle those beads. Like, they just did not know how to deal with the fact that their actress's head made noise every time it moved.
I know.
Yeah. Quit your whining, rich boy. That's like...
He never says, I'm too old for this, right?
Right.
I was trying to watch for it like a hawk, but I didn't catch it. But he talks so much about being old, and he is 42.
Dude, I am older than he is in this. I'm older now than he is in this movie.
That just did not hit with me at all.
So little of this movie does. Maybe, you know, in addition to the, you know, is this before most rom-coms tropes were established? If you look back at the glowing reviews for this movie.
Yeah, I read Ebert's 4-star review.
Oh, God.
It's like, you know, everyone is so impressed that that it's dealing with quote, male menopause.
I forgot that that was a phrase.
Like, did we just not address this in movies between the 7-year itch and the late 70s? Is that like, like, did we just forget about this for a while and this is when they came back? And so every critic who was also a slightly schlubby white guy was like, yes.
I mean, I think maybe that's the thing, is I was thinking about this, like, historically when I was thinking about, you know, the tropes thing. I'm like, well, what is the last, what are the other rom-coms, right, from this era? And like, Annie Hall stuck out. But then I was like, what are some of the 60s rom-coms? And I was like, dot, dot, dot. I can't think, like, The Apartment, I guess, you know, like, I don't know if maybe there were a lot of rom-coms and that they just haven't survived the test of time. The 60s is by far the era of movies I've seen the least of. So, right. Or I mean, I guess I've seen the least of, like, you know, the 20s, but I mean, of more recent, like, I've seen more movies from the 50s and the 70s than from the 60s is what I'm trying to say. So maybe I'm missing something. I genuinely don't know.
I guess Breakfast at Tiffany's comes up as one from the 60s.
Same director.
Is it? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this Blake Edwards.
And that's probably the only one that, like, comes up when you Google that I have seen. And, you know, The Apartment is also in there, as well as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, apparently.
Ha! Okay, so, no.
But I don't completely buy that.
No, I don't think so.
Well, we're not going to get any clarity from the Factsy segment, but let's get it out of the way. 10 was released October 5th of 1979, won its opening weekend with $3.5 million. The only other thing we know about this weekend is that Alien was still hanging around in its 20th weekend. Things were different. Movies stayed. This is going to be a light one because we don't have a lot of solid box office data. It did go on to make $74.8 million, probably the seventh highest grossing film of 1979, right behind Apocalypse Now and two behind Alien. It outgrossed The Jerk, Moonraker, and The Muppet Movie. I would have assumed that all three of those made more than this movie, and I would have been wrong. Somehow, 10 was nominated for 2 Oscars and 5 Golden Globes. It lost all of them. Henry Mancini's score was the only thing nominated at both. It lost the Oscar to A Little Romance, and it lost the Golden Globe to Apocalypse Now. The song It's Easy to Say, which we heard towards the end of the film, was nominated for Best Original Song. It lost to It Goes Like It Goes from Norma Rae.
Dope song. Definitely deserves an Oscar.
It doesn't deserve that Oscar because Rainbow Connection from the Muppet movie should have won.
No, Goes as It Goes is better. Sorry. Fight me, nerds.
The other Golden Globes it lost were Best Comedy or Musical. It lost to Breaking Away from the director of The Deep. What's his name? Peter Yates?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dudley Moore was nominated for Actor in a Comedy, lost to Peter Sellers in Being There. Peter Sellers, incidentally, turned down this role what's
Edwards
his name
also
in 10
the Pink Panther series.
Julie Andrews was nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical, lost to Bette Midler in The Rose. And Bo Derek was nominated for the bygone New Star of the Year Actress Award, which they were almost done handing out. That only made it a few years into the 80s. She lost that also to Bette Midler in The Rose. So Bette Midler beat 2 different actresses from this movie for Golden Globes. And now it's pretty much trivia because there's very little other solid information. The film 10 prompted a massive surge in sales of Ravel's Bolero and apparently generated more than $1 million in royalties to Ravel's estate. He was briefly the best-selling classical composer in 1979 as a direct result of this film. Dudley Moore was a last-minute replacement. Peter Sellers turned it down repeatedly. George Segal was actually on set and started working and apparently got pissy that the script had been reworked so that Julie Andrews was more of a character, and that made him mad and he bailed.
What? She's barely a character.
Right?
And when you said she was nominated for Best Actress, I was like, did they see the film?
But by far, my favorite part of the entire film was Julie
Andrews. I mean, she's Julie Andrews.
Right.
I got to say, listen, I'm throwing Colin under the bus for a second. We started this movie, or I started it. Colin was deciding whether or not he was going to stick around while it was on. And he said, are there any famous people in this movie while Julie Andrews was on the screen?
Sir.
I know. I know. And I was like, that's Julie Andrews. And he was like, okay. And I was like, it's Mary Poppins!
Mary fucking Poppins, man! I need you to put some respect on it.
Exactly. Anyway.
Admittedly, there's some cognitive dissonance when you're hearing Mary Poppins say the phrase new remote controlled screwing device, but I don't think that was Colin's problem.
She was married to Blake Edwards. Oh, was she? Like, yes. The whole time, like until he died.
Wow.
And speaking of Blake Edwards, as a result of this, he sued George Segal and got over $250,000 from him. So that's great. Good. George Segal also was in line to play Arthur. So all of Dudley Moore's greatest successes were replacing George Segal.
That makes sense to me. Also, I can imagine Dudley Moore in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and it's very funny to me.
What else? Others considered for the Bo Derek role included as yet unknown Kim Basinger, as yet unknown Christy Brinkley, and as yet unknown Tanya Roberts. So a veritable who's who of hot people who weren't famous yet. And finally, an explanation on the odd title card. The first thing in this movie is a dedication, the kind of thing that you will occasionally see at the beginning or the end of the credits. Dick Crockett was a stuntman and frequent double for Peter Sellers, who had worked extensively with Blake Edwards, including on all of the Pink Panther movies, had a very long career going back to the 30s. He died suddenly. It's either a heart attack or suicide. It's a little shaky, but it was very, very close with Blake Edwards and died around the time post-production was completed. Hence the very odd dedicating the movie at the beginning of the movie, which right. I don't know if I've ever seen before.
I don't think I've seen that before.
But pretend I didn't end on that note. Pretend I ended on the one about everyone wanting to screw to Bolero after they saw this movie.
Funny.
What'd you say, Camille?
I said, that's funny. I mean, it makes sense, I guess. And through that whole scene between her and George, I was like, is this what sex was like when I was 23? Like, just kind of like, you know, this is whatever. Oh, you got to start the song again. We can't finish until you start the song.
There is a good comedic idea in that.
Right.
Like, that is funny. I feel like if a sketch student came to me with that, with you got to have sex to this one song, choosing Bolero is a funny choice. Right. And then the idea of, oh, you're going too slow, you need to start over. Right. That is funny. The record getting stuck is funny. And I wasn't really laughing, though.
Right. Exactly. Like, it wasn't executed well. Like, you're right. In theory, I should have been cracking up at this.
Right. But on paper, it's all so clever and funny and weird in a really delightful way. And yet it just felt off in the movie.
Is that because of Bo Derek? It was maybe
all she's good for is being very beautiful.
Right. Because, I mean, she was striking in this film. But
yeah.
And I feel like with his correct partner, Dudley Moore could have pulled that scene off. It would have been funny because it was like kind of like halfway there. We're like halfway in the door to funny, but she just wasn't like really pulling her end.
Yeah, no, I feel like I've only ever seen her in this and Tommy Boy. I have like no understanding of who she is.
Yeah, I got nothing else.
Also, I feel like me and Sean are like at the low end of, like, we are just old enough to be aware of 10 to begin with. I feel like our younger listeners are probably like,
what?
You recognize 10? But like, Bo Derek running down the beach was a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think part of the reason why the funny scenes kept not connecting, I was never clear on what I was supposed to be laughing at. Am I supposed to be laughing at, like, oh, this guy is having all of these misfortunes because he's a goof who's trying to be smooth? Like, am I supposed to be laughing at him, or am I supposed to have, like, an amused sympathy? Like, ah, how relatable, trying to capture your mojo back. Like, I don't know what kind of funny this is supposed to be. So I just end up confused.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of slapstick. Like I mentioned, I laughed when he crashed the car because he's too busy ogling. That's funny. Crashing your car into a cop car, period, is funny. Doing it because you're staring at Bo Derek is funnier. And he falls down the hill.
That was
like,
pretty funny.
For like that whole 70s thing where shots go on way, way, way longer than you think they should.
Yeah,
like
he's
rolling down the hill for 4 minutes. Laughed out loud at that. But it doesn't fit with this, like, more Woody Allen-esque, like, oh, you know, what does my masculinity mean in relationship to my dealings with women? Yada, yada, yada. I don't care.
And I'm not even sure, like, I didn't feel like that was even something that he was actually struggling with, or at least even thinking about, that he was cognizant of any of that. I think it was just like, you know, oh, I'm letting my dick lead me to wherever it needs to go. and he's like, you know, sabotaging his relationship with Sam, who's like clearly probably the best thing that's happening to him. He's judgmental of his friend's relationship, which, you know, rightfully so, I guess it ends up being not a real thing anyway. But he spends so much time, like the whole thing with him, like watching his neighbor with his life going on and on, like with the orgies and the free love and all that stuff. That happened too much. Like, we spent too much time on it. Like, I understand there was kind of a payoff, but like, I guess the biggest, the biggest one for me though was at the very end when he's like cussing him out. He's like, that's it, George. He's like, I've been giving you quality R entertainment for like months.
That is true. That was good. I think that you're right. I think that the place where the pathos comes in is with his relationship with Julie Andrews, and that is completely underwritten. Right. And so it just is, it's unfulfilling.
Yeah. Like, I feel like there should have been much more conversation. And I know like we didn't much more conversation about what was going on or not going on with his relationship with Sam. I did really enjoy her scene with his friend when he was like off in Mexico. And I love the fact that she's like, you know, I can't even ask him to step outside because he's too small.
Yeah, that was good.
And I also, at that point, I noticed, I was like, you know what? We haven't seen them stand next to each other. We don't see them standing next to each other until the very last shot of the film. And he is a small man.
I'll get to it when, hey, stick around. You can't handle the truth. We'll deal with Tenet. But never has this been more pronounced than when Kenneth Branagh in Tenet is trying to threaten Elizabeth Debicki and is just staring directly up at her.
Nice.
Like, she's looking at the ground.
One other thing in my notes I want to address is that I wrote down, I feel like I just came dangerously close to seeing Dudley Moore's dick.
The most terrified I was in this entire film.
No, there's a lot of Austin Powers-esque, like, how have I not seen genitalia yet? Like, people are naked the whole time.
Oh, didn't you see, like, full-on snatch? Always, like,
there's definitely bush.
Yeah, absolutely saw some snatch.
Yep.
Well, thank God for that. Because in a movie that is one long erection, it's pretty unsexy. Like, Bo Derek is gorgeous. When she's naked, I am invested, yes. But other than that, it's not like, this isn't like a sexy, like, you know, even the way that, like, you know, a true sex comedy is kind of like titillating. This is just kind of like a sad drama that happens to be about sex.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what the feeling is. And especially, and even just the fact that we don't get enough of like how much he has built her up in his mind. And then for it to get the gravitas of what a letdown it is for him that, you know, like, oh, she's just another fucking 23-year-old who I assume she just basically, when she's comment said, oh, that's a really attractive older man. Okay, sure.
But I really tried to think about that from the perspective of a 22-year-old, if I would say something like that.
I mean, probably.
And I don't know. I just don't know.
Me, no. Personally, as me at 23, there's no way in hell I would have ever said anything like that to anybody in real life who could hear me. But but then again, like, you put into perspective, like, the fact that she just got married like yesterday, her husband almost died, he's in the hospital, and she's like, yes, I want to fuck this dude, let's do it. And she's like, she answers the phone basically with his dick still inside her.
Yes.
If it made it in. I don't want to be explicit here, but I was like, I'm not sure if it even counts yet. I don't know.
Poor mom from E.T. Man.
Oh, God. Right? Like, she has like this, he causes this basically mental breakdown for her, questioning her own sexuality and her life.
And she's gorgeous and charming and funny and like, if anything, she's the most, how do I put it? She's like the most viable match for him in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Like, because right, like, Julie Andrews is clearly too sophisticated for her shit, for his shit.
Right.
And like this, look, I don't think I need to tell anybody this, but ladies, it's never you. If the guy can't, It's got something. You're just fine. It's on him. He's got some problems to work out.
True story. Although from relationship past, I could actually totally relate to Dee Wallace's story about the one guy who couldn't with her several times, and I'm like, wow, Dee, I get you. I feel
every woman has that in their life. Yeah.
And guys, you're making it worse by being weird about it. Just like, hey, weird things happen. The body is a mystery. Just be like, yep, sorry, tonight wasn't the night. What are you doing tomorrow? Like, I know in 1979 we weren't having these conversations yet. I'm just exasperated. Maybe this is the answer. I'm exasperated by this movie because we've had 40 years of cultural dialogue since it came out. Right. And so now it's like, what the fuck is with you, old people?
Yep.
I mean, there's midlife crises, and then there's crashing a hot bride's wedding and stalking her to generic Mexico, which is apparently in the same place as the TMNT Central America, because all he got from that dentist was she's in Mexico, right. And then he called Aero Mexico and landed at the Mexico resort where she was.
Right. I assume in 79, maybe there was only exactly one place in Mexico where Americans were allowed to go when they came to stay there, and that was it. So, and also, who goes to the beach in a sweatsuit while we're at it?
People apparently in the 70s were doing all sorts of inappropriate clothing choices in and around the water.
God, this whole thing is just like a question. Like, yes, it's a very big, with the time shift, was it 40 years later, it's very much apparent in a lot of things, and just things as small as me hearing those phones ringing constantly. Like, that was so GD unnerving for me. Like, I don't know when the last time was I heard an actual phone fucking ring.
The busy signal plotline? I was like, oh, this was a thing. This was a part of our lives for years.
Right. And they just kept trying and kept trying.
I said before we started recording, I was just watching the end of In Bruges. And why did I just blank on Voldemort's name? Ralph Fiennes takes out a map to figure out his way around. And I'm like, man, I remember that. And it was such a pain in the... Like, do you remember being in an unfamiliar city and having to, like, duck around a corner to pull the map out of your... and unfold it? When now it's like, I'm in I don't know where Brooklyn, and I would like to go to Madison Square Garden. And in 6 seconds, your phone is like, take 7 steps forward, right. Go onto the train, wait 8 minutes.
Exactly. That was my existence. Like, when I first moved here to Pittsburgh, I had a map. Like, I had a full-on, like, for realsies map. And I think a few months ago, I was cleaning stuff out, and I found, like, the old map that I had, and it was, like, all marked up with little things and stuff. And, yeah, it was, like, I'll never forget, like, the first visit here to Pittsburgh. We went downtown and we discovered, much chagrin, that there's 7th Streets with a number and then the 7th spelled out. You know, that whole thing. And that fucked us up for like a whole day. Like, that just like messed us fucked up our whole everything. So yes, maps, God bless them. I am old enough to remember actually having to use them. And then the transition, oh my God, MapQuest.
It was so great to be able to print out step-by-step directions and leave them on a clipboard on your passenger seat.
Yes.
As much as that was a big step forward, when something went wrong, it was like, well, now we're completely fucked because we don't have a map. We have no idea where we are. We trusted those. They led us astray. Right. Now we'll never get home again.
You would go into a gas station. Which had human beings at it.
Right.
You would have a conversation with a stranger.
Oh my God.
Rough times.
Tell them about, be vulnerable with them. Be like, hey, look, I don't know where I'm going. I need your help, please, stranger.
bad
anyway,
times.
Anyway, was there anything else good in 10? Oh, I legitimately loved the scene where he has begun his stalking with the priest. And the priest is like, I'm a songwriter. And he has to sit through a terrible...
Yes, I love the old lady.
And the old lady. The whole scene was good. Having to listen to that song and pretend it was okay was a fitting punishment for this douchebag. And I looked up, like, that was also by Henry Mancini. And apparently Blake Edwards was like, just write the worst song you can possibly write. And he was terrified that it would accidentally become a giant hit.
Oh,
and
my
he
God.
Would have to, like, go accept the Oscar. Oh, but it was...
Pittsburgh, that shout out good. To Henry Mancini. He was not born in Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh claims him as their own.
Hey, if I ever become famous, Pittsburgh can claim me.
And I would like to acknowledge that you are one of the great Anglo-Saxon heterosexual bores of all time is an A-plus insult. That I would like to incorporate into my own usage on a regular basis. I mean, I feel like people who are obsessed with this era and with 10 are going to think we paid it, you know, gave it short shrift, but like, sorry if you didn't see this when you were activated by it. It's just kind of fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand why it's so iconic, and why so many scenes, like Sean had mentioned, that, you know, the beach romp was 122 minutes long. Like, that was completely unnecessary and uncalled for. So much dragged on.
Do you ever think about what movies were a really big deal at the time for us that are going to be total, like, curiosities like this? Like,
yeah.
The first thing I thought of was There's Something About Mary.
Right.
Right, like, I feel like the hair gel bit might, I don't even know if kids today know about that.
Right.
But I feel like kids today might know about that in the way that I knew about Bo Derek on the beach.
Right.
And that if kids today went back and watched that movie, they would be like, what?
Yeah, there's been a lot of movies. There's a lot of, like, my favorite movies that do not withstand the test of time. And, you know, people will also be like, oh, maybe I should watch it. I'm like, no, don't bother. You've missed the boat.
You missed
like,
it. Yep.
You missed it. You can't go back to it. Like, if you watch it now, it's going to look like shit. And so just don't. Don't bother.
Let's look back at a little film called Garden State.
Yeah, this is probably in the same vein as that.
In retrospect, that's a movie about two people who don't seem to work but are fine.
Right.
Just spending 2 hours not deciding whether or not they should fuck because they're too sad about nothing. Like,
wait a minute. I might be confusing Garden State with another Zach Braff film with Jacinda from, I don't know. Keep going.
It's the one with Natalie Portman where he's like an actor with mental health issues, and they meet and they're hipsters together for a while, and then he like is gonna leave town, but then he doesn't. That's
Peter
the whole
Sarsgaard's
goddamn
a grave digger, grave robber.
No,
grave digger.
I was thinking of,
but he robs graves also.
Probably.
I was thinking of a different film where Zach Braff is married or engaged to some broad, and he cheats on her with some new girl, and it's not the Last Kiss. That's
Last
it.
Kiss, yes. Directed by Tony Goldwyn.
Shut the fuck up! Tony, look at you! Look at you! I had no idea.
That, and I wonder how the serious Gen X comp, you know, the Empire Records and the...
Empire Records is the perfect example of a movie where I would not tell a child now to watch that.
No, I'm it like, means I'm... nothing to them. It would mean yeah. nothing. Record store, what is that? What is a record?
Right.
Why are all these people and talking reality, to each other in person?
Reality Bites and Clerks and like the entire like, oh, we're singles. 25 and what's going on? Like, nothing. You're fine. Live your life. Like, that does not translate.
Oh, it's so hard to be alive in the 90s. Unprecedented peace and prosperity.
And yet, because I'm just on the bottom fringe, like I hear the Replacements singing about being sad about nothing. And I'm like, yeah. Like, we had a lot of feelings for no reason.
It's the human condition.
Yes.
And well, that must be what this is like. Mm-hmm. Like as you said, Roger Ebert, this was his number 10 film. It was his number 10 film of the year. 4 stars. Both Siskel and Ebert liked it. The New York Times loved it. 5 Golden Globe nominations. Like, I think that this notion in the late 70s, again, it's a very male notion that like, oh, I'm in my 40s now and the world looks different and I don't understand why. And I think I want to fuck everything, but I feel bad about that. Like, this was a relatable feeling at that period of time.
I mean, they still make this movie like twice a year, every year.
Yeah.
So
are there any, I mean, there's got to be some from the female point of view. Like, I mean, do they
get TV like, high fidelity?
Which fuckers canceled.
I know.
Yeah. Well, let's, having acknowledged our generational inability to do so, let's rate it anyway. I landed on a 54. This was a pure, like, looking at my list and going, it's better than this. It's not as good as that. I'm less glad I watched it than The Deep, even though I gave it a higher score than The Deep. But, 54.
I'm doing a gut feeling instead of checking the accounting, but I landed on 55.
Okay, I got 48.
Someone with a math degree, tell us, you know, when we hit the movie with our slimmest deviation from one another, because that's pretty close.
Yeah.
We're all within 7 points of one another, and a 52 and a third overall.
Yep.
We remain dealing with the utter mediocrity of the late 1970s, but it's not Transformers. There are no Ninja Turtles involved. We didn't Take have it. To watch Four Christmases.
Yeah, this was better than watching Four Christmases, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. So the bingo card, I don't know.
Think we have anything.
This hasn't Gotta. Been made. No. I thought, was there any kind of a cameo in this? Because they kept mentioning, like, I met you at so-and-so's party.
Right.
But, like,
Truman Capote's?
No actual, like, random famous person showed up.
No.
Shout out, though, to young, svelte Brian Dennehy. Right? Look at the recently deceased was just a strapping young lad in this film.
Very handsome. I thought for a hot second, though, I thought his character was going to be gay. I mean, I was kind of hoping that it was, because it seemed like he was flirting with him, like, heavily.
How about a really awkward scene where Dudley Moore talks to his therapist, and his therapist is like, would you trade it for being homosexual?
Right?
And he's like, God, no.
Right? I'm like, wow. And we're like, threw around the F word a couple times too. And I'm like, okay, yeah. 79. Gotcha. real uncomfortable, like real offensive and fuck.
It's weird drawing a line around that. Now, Robin, you've been dealing with this on the Keanu review, where both of the earlier Bill and Ted movies have
the hard F.
Oof.
The hard F slur. It's really tricky because, like, every time you hear it now, it's so like, ooh, geez, no. But, like, if you look at the era, it's in, like, every other comedy.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's hard going, like, do I decide whether or not to cancel this particular one?
You don't need to cancel it. I don't think it's inappropriate to go, though.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As long as we don't continue to use it.
Right.
Yeah. It's time for You Can't Handle the Truth. I'm sorry, Robin and Camila, right before we started recording, you determined you had both watched...
The Vow.
The Vow.
The
on
documentary
HBO.
Series on about Nexium.
ESP Nexium. Yeah. It's a cult. And the reason we started talking about it is because we record over Skype. And for anybody who's ever recorded a Skype session, it says, like, avoid legal snags by informing participants they're being recorded. And at the end of the second episode, the one lady's like, because one of the guys in the cult is a documentarian.
Right.
And, like, I understand that they were like, oh, we can make a documentary about the cult leader. But right. I'm like, you are asking for trouble if you get a documentarian in the inner circle of a cult. Things
exactly.
are going to go wrong for you.
Right. I was surprised. I'm still, like, not clear. I would like to understand the legality of everything. Like, I'm not clear, like, how he's allowed to use this footage for this purpose, or if he's even one of these. The filmmakers of this documentary series, or if he's just a subject who's, like, you know, offered up all of his footage. And
I do not think he is a filmmaker. I think he is a subject. I do think he was breaking the law in some of these recordings.
Right.
I do think Aunt Beirut was breaking the law with some of these recordings.
Right. Because the girl's
I'm
like, you know,
really glad that they recorded those things because I really like listening to it. Like, I'm really interested in what happened. It's so creepy. It's so weird. And I'm so really, creepy. Really enjoying the series.
Yes, absolutely. I would highly suggest it. I would also suggest you listen to the podcast Surviving Nexium, which this was probably like, I listened to this like maybe a year ago. And that's like probably 10 parter or something like that. I think it's called Surviving Nexium. And
yep.
Yeah, it's so good.
So good, because I didn't realize that only 2 episodes had aired of this series when I started it last night.
Yeah,
and when I finished the second episode, I was like, "But I want more!"
Right.
So I've got the podcast. Thank you, Camila.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, if you guys are into that sort of thing, I would highly suggest watching The Vow, because it's, again, like, it had the same things, like, you know, Scientology and Leah Ramey's docu-series. I don't know if you watched that at all.
I watched Going Clear.
Oh God, that one is like scary.
Yeah,
like, that one like gave me feelings of like a horror film, like for real.
Yeah.
I felt really dirty and wrong after I finished watching that one.
Yeah. But, that was unpleasant. Yeah. Sad.
But I also watched The Relic, which, fuck that movie, man. Like that.
Really? What? I that was one of the only, I mean, I feel like I saw 12 low budget horror films that got more attention than they ordinarily would have because they came out mid pandemic, and Relic is the one I missed. So I don't need to go back to it.
No, I mean, did you enjoy Heredity?
Yeah.
It's probably in that same vein. I did not. I enjoyed Heredity, but I felt like cheated. This, I didn't really enjoy it, and I also felt cheated. Like, I was like, I wasted 2 hours and $7 on this movie. I could have been doing something else. Like, Heredity, they had, like, a lot of, they had some good scenes, and Toni Collette always, you know, I'm always
she's
thrilled
so good.
Yeah, to watch her. But this was just like, ugh, snore, snooze, God. And then the ending's like, ugh, okay.
That's the thing. You can't be boring right now. Like, right? Like, especially if most people are going to watch your thing at home or in the drive-in, two places where they can look at their phone. Like, you know, if you're going to be long and slow, this is not what we need in 2020.
Right.
Wait until people are trapped with you again.
Exactly. And you saw Tenet.
Yeah. Let's talk about the best time travel film of 2020, Bill and Ted Face the Music, because I'm not kidding. Bill and Ted is better. Like, Robin, have you seen Bill and Ted yet?
Yes. What? That's a ridiculous question, Sean. I'm offended that you asked.
I didn't know what your schedule was like.
No, to be fair, I didn't see it until Sunday. And on both Friday and Saturday, I was like, it's absurd that I haven't seen this movie. I haven't seen Tenet. Fuck Tenet. I liked Bill and Ted a lot. If you want to hear me talk about it for an hour, there's going to be a new episode of the Keanu Review coming out probably before this episode drops. Nice. So check that out. But Sean,
right,
please
so
carry on.
I will cede the Bill and Ted talk to the Keanu Review.
Bill and Ted talk.
I did legitimately. The Ted talk. I, man, missed right? joke opportunity. But I did legitimately like Bill and Ted, particularly in 2020. I was like, man, their confidence is what I needed right now.
That's exactly what we said in Keanu Reeves. It's just, it was a pleasant, kind, diverting movie. And boy, do we need that right now. But Tenet.
And anytime I want to feel good about myself, I just remember that Bill and Ted named their daughters after one another. And that just is so heartwarming and wholesome.
Oh, my goodness.
Tenet. So Tenet. Look, I
normally edit out a lot of Sean's thought noises. I'm going to leave every single one of those.
Right.
That's, yeah, I feel like because that's a review that's the sound of someone trying to reckon with Tenet. It's you should trust me about this because I'm still the person that says Interstellar is a classic movie. Okay, I am not a Nolan hater. I appreciate what he does. I like most of his movies. And when everyone in the world was like, "This is some self-indulgent bullshit with Interstellar," I was like, "This is the best movie of the year." I am not skewed against him, and Tenet is just 2.5 hours of him seeing how hard he can make it for the audience. This plot could have been streamlined. It could have been made more simple. And what it's not like Memento, where it's like when you put it all together, it becomes more rich and rewarding. It's just if you decide to go all the way through every like one of the 72 explanation scenes in Tenet and make sense of what's happening in the movie, you would go, oh, okay. Like, it's just difficult for the sake of being difficult. And it's no fun. It's got this, like,
but
you know.
There's so many pretty suits. Is that not fun? And Elizabeth Peggy, as long as a boat. That's not fun.
And her dresses, her wardrobe, excellent. It spends so much time trying to show off the fact that it's a time travel movie. Mm. There have been a billion time travel movies. Like, I know that Christopher Nolan's like, no, this is about inversion, where things move backwards. They're not traveling through time. They're moving in reverse and temporal. Fuck off! Like, the fact that you made it more complicated and clever are not synonyms,
right.
And he thinks they are in this case. The performances are fine. John David Washington is very good. Robert Pattinson's very good. Elizabeth Debicki is great because she can't help but be. She's amazing. It's just, if this is the movie that is supposed to get everybody back in the theaters, I'm glad that it's not better than it is, because maybe people won't go spread COVID at a movie theater. It's it's obviously not living up to its hype a little bit.
Like, that movie was overhyped before it became somehow pinned down as the savior of cinema.
Right.
Like, there's no way that anything can live up to that. But I do want to say, Sean, that I think that I totally believe you that Tenet is not very good.
Right.
But I do think that you're like, I don't have animosity against Nolan. I bet you do have a little bit of what I have going on, where it's like, fuck you, dude. Let people not get COVID.
Well, yeah, that's definitely in there. That, like, now, I understand he was never releasing this on streaming. He is one of those people, like David Lynch, like Spielberg, that is such an advocate for the theatrical experience that no one was going to see this until they could see it on a big screen.
Right. There's no reason that couldn't be late 2021.
Right.
Exactly. Like, there was no rush to do this. And, like, the way that the marketing is in focus on, see it at a drive-in or at a socially distanced indoor theater if you feel comfortable. The marketing is, see it in fucking IMAX. Like, it's frustrating. I am frustrated by that. That said, I'm looking at the list and I'm trying to decide if this is the worst Christopher Nolan movie, and I think it is. That said, it's because the cast is good, it's visually impressive. Sometimes we talk about a movie that, like, you can't really give a bad score because there's nothing wrong with it. Mm. This is one of those. We've talked about, like, when I do Rotten Tomatoes voting, sometimes there's a rotten 6 out of 10, like 7 through 10 is fresh. 1 through 4 is rotten. 5 and 6 can go the other way. If, like, it's an overachieving 5, it might be fresh. If it's an underachieving 6, it might be rotten. This is a rotten 6. Like, this is, on paper, this is an above average movie. How dare you only have it be above average?
Right.
Like,
right.
With all of these tools and all of this hype, why is this just like, yeah, that was okay, I guess.
That's messed up.
But really, I'm looking back and, like, I haven't seen his 69-minute debut following, but having seen every other Christopher Nolan movie, this is the worst one.
Mm.
And that's a shame for him and the theater and the people who get sucked into seeing it.
Shame on you, Chris. Shame.
Yeah.
And get over your fucking self.
Right.
He really is not over his fucking self. Is it the case? Yeah. So, like, all of the good ones are written by him and his brother, Jonathan Nolan.
You know, I like Insomnia.
Yeah,
I read an article. That's not, because I read a, like, ranking the Nolan movies, and they put that maybe at the bottom, and they were like, it's his only foray into being a work for hire director. And I was like, that is not what that movie is.
I don't recall. I just recall walking away from it like, I'm pretty sure Al Pacino actually had insomnia in this movie, because he just got is the way he's walking around the entire film. I was like, good on you, man. Way to go, Al. But I don't recall if I enjoyed it or not.
I thought Al Pacino was genuinely great in that movie. I don't know if that was before or after 1 Hour Photo, but I know I saw it before 1 Hour Photo. So that was definitely, like, really a big deal for me to see Robin Williams be sinister in that way.
Right.
And yeah, I haven't seen it since it came out, but I really liked that movie.
Well, I'm sure there will be people who are like, this is the worst Christopher Nolan movie except for Interstellar. As one of the few Interstellar stands, that's not going to be me. But yeah, after Interstellar, so for Dunkirk and Tenet, he stopped co-writing and is writing them himself. And
Boy. Okay.
So, yeah.
Speaking of movies I saw 20 years ago, my other You Can't Handle the Truth was that I rewatched Chicago this weekend, and Chicago's awesome.
Dude, I fucking love Chicago.
So, like, I'm having this whole maybe I was wrong about musicals the whole time thing ever since we watched Fiddler recently. And then I watched Into the Woods this week, which is bad.
Into the Woods.
Do you remember that movie at all?
I liked it, but, like, I was giving it a lot of credit. Like, I just think that musical is very, like, emotionally affecting, and it had a great cast. Into the Woods definitely has a great cast. Like, Into the Woods was in my top 10 this year, and it's what that year, and it was one of those where, even at the time, I was like, maybe not.
Well, I was hating it deeply, and Rob Marshall directed that, and I was like, and I didn't really like Mary Poppins Returns, so I was like, do I just hate him? Do I just hate his movies? And I was scrolling through HBO, saw Chicago, and I was like, I'm just going to put this on. I'm just going to put it on. And I was immediately sucked in and was like, no, this movie's great. And I was being a snob when I was 18 and said it wasn't any good.
Yeah, that movie's the shit, man. I love there's probably like five musicals that I am just like, yes. And that is definitely one of them. And even Richard Gere in that, dude, like, come on. And then like Surprise Lucy Liu, like, dude, like.
I got like so excited when Lucy Liu showed up. I was like, oh, and she looks so young. I was like so excited.
God, if I could sing, like, and I had any aspirations to be an actress, I would want to play Velma in Chicago.
Yeah.
Like, that would be my dream role.
Catherine Zeta-Jones is just phenomenal, just so good. Anyway, that's my You Can't Handle the Truth, a 20-year-old movie.
And I guess
it's one of the 1, 2, 3, 4 musicals I've seen on Broadway, and that was great too.
Nice.
And because no one really cares anymore, and it's been playing for 84 years or whatever, you can see it for like $50. It's great.
If definitely, you know, seems Broadway like it would be worth $50, yeah. Right? If that's a thing.
I would like to take this time to go ahead and give other things that I watched was like Black Panther like 5 times, and also Get On Up, and so R.I.P. Chadwick Boseman. And like this, like, dude, woo, child, like, this was one of like 4 celebrities that I have cried real tears over their death. And I just like, I was, and then you keep finding out more and more awesome things about Chadwick, about his life and who he was and all he did and all he gave. And it's just like, not only like were you doing all this stuff, like you were fighting your own battle and secretly and keeping it, all of it, close to the vest. Like, even like all of his work and charity and just like just awesomeness and everything just to himself, like nobody really even knew. And then just like all everything that he put into creating Black Panther, like the fact that he was the one that was like, hey, let's make sure he speaks Xhosa. That
was beautiful. Xhosa. Nicely done. I can't do it.
And he learned the lines in Civil War, like there on set, like in Xhosa. And how? Who does that? Are you kidding me? He's like,
I'm gonna learn this
right quick in this language that not very many Americans even know exists, let alone speak. I'm gonna just do this real quick and let's shoot it. Bet.
Also, I want to say that when Civil War came out, I remember asking my friends in South Africa where I used to live, like, hey, how's the Xhosa? And that's how you say it if you can't make the clicky sound. They were all like, pretty good.
Nice.
So. Yeah, gets the thumbs up from my random acquaintances in South Africa.
Because I think the guy who plays his father, that's his native language.
Yeah, John Connie.
Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's no level at which it isn't, you know, it's kind of navel-gazy to like compare which ways that a celebrity passes are more upsetting than others.
Right.
You know, but
this is the most even upsetting.
It kind of is, you know. It's usually if somebody dies suddenly, it's a terrible accident, mm-hmm. like Paul Walker, or you know, more rarely an act of violence, whether self-inflicted or otherwise. But to have lost legitimately one of the most important people to movies in this decade or the 21st century, period.
Right.
With no idea that he was sick, and then to learn the circumstances of that, it's devastating and really, you know, I appreciated him a ton, and I feel like I didn't appreciate him enough.
Same.
That's exactly how I feel.
Same. Like I had a lot of admiration and appreciation for him, but again, because he's just not one of those celebrities that was out there grandstanding exactly. And, you know, I didn't hear a lot about him. He wasn't always in the media eye. I appreciated him as an actor and all his characters that he brought to life as well as kept alive. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things like, damn. And, you know, and also like there were times that I had seen interviews with him and I got this impression that, oh, he seems kind of haughty. Like he seems like he's like really like into himself, but in all actuality, dude was probably in pain. Like he was probably
right.
Like, so it's just another one of those things. Like you don't know what people are going through when you pass judgments on them. And it's, oh God, it's just, yeah, it's a
brutal.
It sucks so bad. And it's like, and you think about it, it's like, dude, I can barely make my way to the kitchen if I have a bad cold, let alone like you dude's fighting right. cancer and he's like shooting Black Panther.
Yeah.
It's unimaginable. It's a cliche. It's just like, I keep getting sad about all of the movie, like I'm imagining him as an actor in his 60s doing right. movies that are appropriate for that age. And like, I feel like the world has been robbed of like his second chapter and his
right.
Anyway, it's really sad.
Yes.
Ugh.
What should people watch? Have that make it an action item to go and appreciate. I think there's a lot of people that haven't seen Get On Up.
Get On Up
did not make it didn't make a lot of money. I mean, it made some money, but it was not the level of hit that 42 was.
Right.
And Get On Up is great.
Oh, yeah.
I never saw 42. Is that worth watching?
Yeah. And I would
for him.
Yeah. And okay. Marshall is also very good. Where he
Marshall is another case where like the movie itself was kind of like it was okay.
Yeah.
And yet he was on my best actor ballot
right.
that year.
Because yes. that okay, so I this is walking a fine line of speaking ill of the dead, but I don't think I'm doing it. That movie, because it's a making fun of the movie and not him. Mm. There's a thing that happens in historical movies where a sidekick, like there's a cameo appearance from another historical figure. Mm. And so when they show up, it's like, hello, John Lennon of the Beatles. They make fun of it a lot in Walk Hard, right?
Right.
In yeah. that movie, I think it's Chili from TLC walks in and he goes, Zora! Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh my God. Oh,
and
God.
It's just like the most awkward, obvious example of that. And that also is a good explanation of everything that is wrong with that movie.
Yeah.
Is like it playing into hokey history movie tropes.
Yeah.
But he is great in it. He's great in everything.
I know it. But I mean, I guess, yeah, as all for all, I would highly recommend Get On Up because it's told in kind of a wonky way, but it's actually pretty good. Because I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, yeah, this is cool. But then like I watched it again recently because it just happened to be on this weekend. And yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And if you want to steer into the skid of your feelings here, watch The Five Bloods.
Oh,
where he's a ghost whose presence hangs over the
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I mean, you really want to like just dig in there and just like dig in deep and get those tears a-flowing.
But he was great. And I hate to turn to such trivialities, but Robin.
Mm.
Posthumous Oscar possibility. Okay,
I was literally going to say everybody's tacky post Chadwick Boseman dying thing was what's going to happen to Black Panther 2.
Right.
My tacky thing was, is it supporting actor or best actor? I don't know which character he's playing in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Right.
It's going to be that movie would have to be the worst thing. It would have to be worse than Transformers to not get him a posthumous nomination.
Yeah.
Well, my question is The Five Bloods. I mean, he could win. They could probably push him for supporting actor this year for Five Bloods.
I do not know the extent of his role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, so maybe he'll be dual nominated for both movies.
Well, he's like, and he's number one on the list, the cast list. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then posthumous noms in both Best Actor and Best Supporting. That's my theory.
Yeah, that seems.
That is, if
that
there's
seems
an Oscars.
Right.
Right.
Which
right,
still
right.
remains questionable.
Oh.
Thank you, Camila, for steering us there because I didn't know. I like Robin said, I didn't know whether to bring it up or not because there's nothing to say. But we said
except
something.
We're all so sad.
Right.
That's
yeah.
the thing for us
yeah.
to say is that we're all really sad and rest in peace.
Yeah. And anytime his name is mentioned, I get a little choked up. So.
Shall we pick a movie?
Let's pick a movie.
Oh, starting
there
to get scared.
Are no vetoes.
No vetoes in play.
Right?
It's terrifying.
Dangerous times.
Playing it while fast and loose, someone, kids.
While I'm pulling it up, someone tweeted at us that they're almost tempted to watch this movie because of number one movie in America. It is a DVD called Joshua that it stars Tony Goldwyn and F. Murray Abraham.
Oh.
Anybody?
I've got
never
nothing.
Heard of it.
No.
And I'm going to tell them,
do it.
Go with God.
Right?
Academy Award winner F. Murray Abraham
and
from
also,
Pittsburgh.
I'm probably going to go ahead and watch The Last Kiss. This week because Tony Goldwyn directed it. Watch that.
I'm gonna
again.
Also give you a go with God. That sounds like it might be rough.
I mean, I recall there's a song that I found on that movie from the first viewing that I really like. It probably will be a rough.
Also, wait, did you say that Jacinda Barrett is in it?
Yeah, she's
from Real World.
Yes.
Okay.
She is the girlfriend that in which he cheats on.
I knew she had a film career. Like, she was in that firefighter movie.
Yes.
Mark your scorecards. That's the first time we've ever gone to an aside in the middle of the movie draw. That's the last part of the podcast where we didn't devolve into an aside. We've now completely gotten off topic at every conceivable moment. The movie we've drawn is The Time Machine from 2002, starring Guy Pearce. All I remember is having a strong reaction. I don't remember if that was good, bad, if I hated it, if I thought it was, like, weird and quirky and told people to... Like, I remember this existing and me having a feeling about it, and that's it.
Listen, I remember watching this, and I think this is the one that... I hate time travel movies, so... And I think this was the one I was like, they did it right, so... I think we might be good. Yeah. I hope this is the one.
I remember this movie being good, but very cheesy. Me being embarrassed how much I was enjoying it because it was so cheesy.
Right.
Is how I remember that movie. But let's find out.
Yeah, I'm good with it. This will be fun.
This is clearly Tony going, oh, you had some problems with the time travel elements in Tenet, did you? Well, try this on for size.
Camila says it holds up.
I said it might.
Unless you have... exhaustive knowledge of forgotten disco hits. No one will answer this question. 10 was released October 5th, 1979. What was the number one song in America?
Was it Donna Summer?
Right.
Still no.
Bee Gees.
This man barely has a Wikipedia page.
Oh, God.
It's a male solo artist.
Like, I'm like, should we do charades? Should you be like, first syllable?
If I were a recent Tim Burton movie, but I was more depressed than just large.
Than just
large. Little Dumbo?
I'll try it a different way. If I were a recent Tim Burton movie starring Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, a recent Tim Burton movie about
Big
art
Eyes. History,
but I was more depressed than large.
Bum Eyes?
Sad Eyes?
The name of the song is Sad Eyes, yes.
Okay. Oh, the name of the I've song is Sad Eyes.
Who sings it?
The star of Taxi Driver and the star of Say Anything had a baby and couldn't decide who to name it after, so they just gave it both of their first names, you would have
Taxi Driver and Robert
John.
That is literally the man's name. Is Robert John.
There is a person named Robert John who has a song called Sad Eyes, and it was number one hit.
It was the number one song in America on October 6th, 1979.
All right.
You have got to be kidding
me. I listened to it 2 hours ago. I already don't know what it is because that's how long it stays in your mind.
Number one movie in America.